I'm Rebecca Lavoie, your host for the Undisclosed Addendum episodes on the Pam Lanier case. You might know me as the audio producer for Undisclosed, but I'm also a journalist, the author of several true crime books, and host of the podcast Crime Writers On. Today, we have three guests for the addendum, and our first guest is Amber Hunt. She's an award-winning reporter for the Cincinnati Inquirer and the author of three true crime books. She's also the host of one of my favorite podcasts, Accused, which has had seasons focused upon solving the deaths of Elizabeth Andes and Rita Welch. And her new podcast, Aftermath, premieres next Tuesday, May 22nd. Hello, Amber.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
And also with us is Rabia Chaudhry, one of the hosts of Undisclosed and the author of the New York Times bestseller and non-story and co-host of the 45th podcast. Rabia, it's always wonderful to talk to you.
Great to be here with you, Rebecca.
Also with us is Colin Miller, one of the hosts of Undisclosed, the blog editor at Evidence Prof Blog, and a law professor and associate dean at the University of South Carolina School of Law, and of course, my favorite legal Siri. Hello, Colin.
Hey, Rebecca. How are you?
I am great because this series, mind blown, that's all I'm going to say. And I know that I'm not alone on that. It was so much fun to produce such a fascinating series around the Pam Lanier case. And this week, the Undisclosed team, you guys put out your fourth episode on this case. Pam Lanier, of course, was convicted in the 1997 death of her husband, Dorian, in Chincapin, North Carolina. The episode focused upon new evidence that Dorian was self-medicating with animal drugs, as well as the conclusions by several experts, a super friends band of experts, that Dorian's drinking of the turkey water would explain his arsenic poisoning. Now, before we get to the final episode in the case, Rabia, there was some news in Adnan Syed's case this week, and I would be remiss if I didn't ask you about it right at the top of the show. I do want to get to the Pam Lanier case, obviously, but the state did file a petition this week in Adnan's case. What can you tell us about that?
Right. So we were waiting to see whether or not the state filed a writ of cert, which is essentially asking the highest court in Maryland, can we appeal, basically? They don't have a direct right to appeal. And generally speaking, the state waits until the very last minute or day, which was going to be the end of the 16th. Is that, I think that's today, but they actually did file it a little bit earlier. So essentially, they're asking, they're making the argument based on the issue that they lost with the Court of Special Appeals, which is the Asia issue, the alibi issue, for the Court of Appeals to hear it. And we have, Adnan's team now has, I think, up to 15 days or so since they filed it to file a cross writ, saying, okay, if you're going to hear it, hear our issue too, which is a cell tower issue. Mm-hmm. And then the court can say yes or no to hearing the writ. If they, I think, Colin, you had written that they'll most likely by August will make a decision. Is that right? Is that just kind of like a standard thing? Or
yeah, they generally take about 6 to 8 weeks to render an opinion. So if you imagine that the defense is filing toward the end of this month, we're looking right there in that July-August period to hear whether the Court of Appeals is taking this case or deciding we're going to let the lower court's opinion stand.
Now, Colin, you wrote in one of your blogs about what you identified as two falsehoods in their filing. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah. And so basically, this is something that the state has repeated over and over again. And in fact, the Court of Special Appeals noted it wasn't true. And that is that the Asia alibi conflicts with what Adnan told his attorney and the police, which is that he stayed on campus between the end of school and the start of track practice. And of course, there's this whole debate about is the public library, which is essentially right on the same grounds as the school, whether that's actually different from the school. But putting that aside, there's actually no documentary evidence that Adnan ever said that he remained on school campus between the end of school and the start of track. And so this is an argument the defense should be able to pretty clearly turn aside. And then the second is that, and this is something that Theroux argued before the Court of Special Appeals, his claim is it made sense for Gutierrez not to call Asia as an alibi witness because she did what's called an alibi by routine. In other words, that Adnan's routine was you finish school, you remain at school, you go to track practice, you go to the mosque. But the problem is that, and again, this is something that the Court of Special Appeals identified, there were no witnesses at trial who ever testified that Adnan had a routine of staying at school between the end of classes and the start of practice. And so it's a false dichotomy where they're saying the defense had to choose, do we do Asia or do we do alibi routine? But in fact, there was no alibi by routine at trial. And so therefore, those are two big issues I think that the state is trying to press, but that I think the defense can push back against pretty easily.
Well, I guess we will just have to wait once again and see what happens, what the next filing is, what the decision is. And here we still are on the hamster wheel of justice around this case. It's really something. We're many, many years into it. And, you know, obviously we're all hanging on every development. But I think this was something that I know, Rabia, you weren't necessarily surprised that happened, right?
No, we weren't. I mean, I don't think anybody was surprised, and especially because, I mean, the alternative was, if they don't file it, they just let it go, then what would happen is it would land in the DA's office, and for them to schedule a trial or to do something with it. They are in the middle of an election year right now. The primaries are coming up in June. Right. I can't imagine that Mosby would want, the DA would want to deal with this in the middle of her election, or that anybody, any of the candidates would. So we didn't expect it. I was surprised, I will say, I heard or I was told or something that the Attorney General was going to replace, it would be a different prosecutor who was going to make the decision or who was going to be at least on the writ if it was filed. But it's the same old guy, same old theory. So I was surprised at that. I mean,
our favorite volunteer prosecutor,
Yes, I mean, it's a lot to do juggling, you know, an election and a campaign and making sure you keep Adnan Syed in jail. So,
yeah. All right. Well, let's talk about this fourth episode of the Pam Lanier series. Now, we heard a couple of pretty astonishing things. One of them was that there is this Super Friends panel of experts that Colin was able to assemble that basically blew apart this idea that Doran's consumption of this medicated turkey water from a hose was probably unconnected to his death by arsenic poisoning. Now, Amber, you have talked to experts in your reporting, right, about, you know, different theories of crimes, different kinds of, you know, things that are brought to trial. What did you think of this episode? And what did you think of, you know, Collins having assembled like these, to my ear, sounded like the preeminent experts in the subject, including, by the way, one of the scientists who actually like made it exposed the fact that cyanide was being fed to poultry in the United States.
Yeah, I found that incredibly effective. So unless I learned today that Colin interviewed 47 others who are like, oh no, this is all bullshit. Oh, am I allowed to say bullshit? Yes. Oh no, this is all garbage. And only chose these ones who presented this particular stance, I found that really, really effective.
Well, Colin, was that the case? Did you talk to 47 other people who disagreed and you only included like the five who did?
No, I reached out to what I thought were the six leading ones in the field. The five you heard from on the episode, the sixth said, it's a little bit beyond my scope of expertise, so I can't really comment. So yeah, you heard from the five who responded to me, and they all were in concert saying, look, this fully explains his arsenic poisoning and contradicted what the defense was told before trial.
Yeah, there was a lot of yelling at the podcast player at that point.
I really loved who was the researcher who she and the guy on the phone together when they just kept saying like, we can't impart enough how much arsenic this was. It's so beyond the amount of arsenic that anyone would consume in any other, we just can't impart it enough. They really seemed fired up about the information that you sent them.
Yeah, because all the research is about sort of secondary exposure. It's something where you eat the eggs from the chicken that had been given the 3-nitro, or some of the soil that has the litter of the poultry and it's getting into your system somehow. This is, by way of contrast, primary ingestion, where according to all the witnesses, he's actually drinking the 3-nitro mixed with water. And so that's why they're saying essentially this is off the charts, because you never hear of cases of primary exposure. It wouldn't make sense for a person to voluntarily ingest this directly.
Now, it's my understanding, just from the reading I've done, that 3-nitro was banned in 2013. Is that the case?
It was. So eventually, over the years, various things happened. 2015 was the final Roxurson 3-nitro is banned. And that came directly, as you said, from Ellen Silbergeld, the expert we heard from Johns Hopkins.
Right. So like the woman who was responsible for the rest of us not like ingesting this toxic material is the person that you talk to in this case to show that, in fact, Pam likely did not have a secret stash of arsenic in her house that she was slipping into her husband's lemonade. I mean, that's pretty impressive, Colin. I have to say, I'm very impressed with your sourcing.
Yeah, and you heard from her, right? It was a complete fluke. They weren't even thinking that this had arsenic in it. They're just investigating turkey medications. They say they could be dangerous. And then the National Chicken Council comes back and says, well, it's not as if we're feeding them arsenic. And that's the reason why this whole investigatory ball gets rolling.
Yeah.
And it leads to all this research that's come out since.
And that's what folks that do what Amber and I do, journalists, that's what we call oh shit moments, when you realize that somebody has given you the rope with which to hang them. Because people, like, that happens, right, Amber? Like, people say the thing that's like the opposite of, like, in some like obfuscation attempt or something. Like, people sometimes say the exact thing that will lead you to the thing that you then later find out.
Absolutely. What it made me think of was when my little sister was 4 and we were all sitting around the dining room table, and my mom said, hey, did you guys notice that the pool skimmer's broken? And my little sister blurted, I didn't hit it against a tree. So it is amazing, though, that even as an adult and when I'm interviewing people, some of whom should know that they are talking to a reporter and that it is on the record, they say the craziest things where you're like, oh, yeah, that's what I need to be investigating right now. And then you go off right. And do it and find it.
Right. And you never would have found it had they not said this self-incriminating thing under the guise of trying to throw suspicion elsewhere. It really is amazing.
Most of our listeners already know that Blue Apron is the leading meal kit delivery service in all of the United States. And while many of you guys know what Blue Apron does, you might not know about the types of meals you eat when you cook with Blue Apron. Because you're not just having, like, burgers for dinner. You're making short rib burgers with a hoppy cheddar sauce on a pretzel bun. You're preparing seared steaks and thyme pan sauce with mashed potatoes, green beans, and crispy shallots. All in under 45 minutes, my friends, you will be a gourmand. And all of this without making a trip to the grocery store. But it's not just that Blue Apron delivers the freshest, most perfectly proportioned ingredients to your front door so that you can make delicious meals. They also do it the right way. Blue Apron sends only non-GMO ingredients and meat with no added hormones. Blue Apron supports a more sustainable food system, and they set the highest standards for their ingredients so you can feel good about the food that you are serving to your family, or hey, eating all by yourself because, you know, it's delicious. And no more menu ruts, because you know what? Blue Apron's menu changes every single week based on what's in season. And the menu's designed by Blue Apron's in-house culinary team. Now, you know, in this month, in May, here's some of the recipes that they're offering. They've got pork chorizo tacos with radishes, roasted potatoes and cajeta cheese, salmon and spicy orange salsa with quinoa and carrot salad, white cheddar cheeseburgers, I'm craving a burger night right now, with balsamic glazed onion and roasted potatoes, and creamy pesto cavatelli with mushrooms and spicy breadcrumbs. So check out this week's menu and get your first 3 meals for free at blueapron.com/undisclosed, because our listeners are getting a special offer. You get your first 3 meals for free. That's right, totally free. All you gotta do is go to blueapron.com/undisclosed. Blue Apron, a better way to cook.
Now, in episode 4, we also heard from this new witness, Pam's and Dorian's neighbor, who basically corroborated what we'd heard anecdotally from other people, is that Dorian was also self-medicating with a gigantic cow syringe. Rabia, what did you think about hearing that information, but also hearing from this witness who was not brought by the defense team to testify at trial?
It's really amazing. This has happened in numerous cases. You go out seeking to talk to people thinking maybe they have some kind of something to corroborate something somebody else said or something. And then they hit you with a piece of information you have no expectation that's going to be coming your way. And it's shocking. And it, you know, it's evidence, basically. I mean, like, they present you with new evidence. I mean, Given Doran's proclivity for using animal medication, you know, my dad's a veterinarian. He worked in large animal husbandry for a long time. It was interesting to me in the series because I'm not going to lie, there are times when my dad has had medications and said, it's essentially the same thing. I mean, like, you know, it's really like human medication. So the dose is different, this and that. And I was listening to it. I was thinking, I don't know how my dad would have reacted to this because he seemed to be making the same argument sometimes, but then like the arsenic stuff is different. But yeah, I guess if people kind of think that, yeah, it's shocking that somebody would do that, especially if you know how big a cow syringe is. But it's also amazing that in many of these cases, there are people who have evidence who've just never, I don't know, it didn't occur to them to come forward. Nobody else spoke to them. But it happens pretty frequently. I mean, in so many of our cases, whether it's like a juror nobody spoke to before and they're like, oh yeah, I did something I totally wasn't supposed to do or a person. It's really important. It's really important to talk to people you wouldn't have, who nobody's ever heard of before.
But here's the thing I don't understand because, you know, I am not a cop, obviously, but I have written about cops a lot and I've reported about cops a lot. And I know a lot about how investigations work. And if they were trying to make a case that she murdered her husband and there was this pattern of abuse or neglect or not letting people see him, isn't talking to the neighbors like a standard procedure when this guy lived like in the next property over or whatever? I would think that would be standard. I mean,
you would think so.
You would think so. What do you think, Colin?
Yeah, I'm the police actually did a pretty thorough investigation. I don't think they spoke to Jackie Graham. The defense obviously did and then made this decision not to call him based upon that person with the same name.
Which, by the way, that is bananas, like super bananas.
Yeah, but I would actually say that the law enforcement investigation in this case was pretty thorough. They talked to a good number of people, and it was like the sheriff's department, it was the State Bureau of Investigation, and it was the different prosecutors who worked in the case. So, yeah, overall, a pretty extensive investigation, despite the fact that they didn't speak to this one individual.
Well, Amber, the jury didn't hear the specific information about Dorian self-medicating. They obviously didn't hear from Jackie because there was somebody else with the same name and they thought they'd get them confused instead of just
thinking, that made a lot of sense.
Yeah, like you can't just tell the jury like this isn't the same guy that you may have seen on the local news. Like it's crazy. But they didn't hear about this. But several witnesses did testify that he was taking animal medications. And Dorian himself said on his deathbed that he did this to himself. I'm just curious, are you head scratching about how this verdict came to be that the jury convicted Pam when the trial was like barely about this case and there was all this other evidence that Dorian was putting other stuff into his body?
On the one hand, I totally am. It's like if I were on the jury, I wouldn't find this beyond reasonable doubt. But on the other, I understand that people in general have a hard time believing that humans can do such harmful things to themselves. So, I mean, for a logical person, that just seems ludicrous. But of course, people hurt themselves all the time. They take drugs, they drink and drive. I learned of a friend's suicide yesterday. But I think that it's comforting to people to think that, oh, surely someone did this to him. He couldn't have done this to himself. And then I think, too, that people generally trust law enforcement. Mm. And I think it goes a long way that in people's heads, they think, well, she wouldn't have been charged if she were innocent. And that goes a long way.
I also think that part of it is also if I was on the jury, one thing I wouldn't, I don't know how sure I would be if, you know, if especially the state didn't prove how she got the arsenic, how she administered the arsenic, any of that. But wondering about, clearly this man is incapacitated, right? Like, how could somebody who's so sick then not actually seek medical attention? And I would be concerned about, and you know, that's the story that the state gave, is that, you know, he was really sick. She didn't take him to get looked at, and that narrative stuck, even though it was actually not true. But you know, whoever tells the best story wins in a courtroom, right? And it just becomes like that just becomes part of what people believe, whether or not the evidence, you know, contradicts it. And I think what might have been convincing is, how is somebody who's not well who's that unwell, you know, his color looks different, so many things are wrong with him, would not get help if he realized that this was doing to him. So that could have been part of it too, that it wasn't so much how he got poisoned, but the fact that it was in her hand to get him well, and clearly he couldn't do anything about it.
If jurists had all the information, though, I don't think it's a huge leap to think that a guy who injects himself with poultry medication might not be totally right. trusting of doctors and might insist that he not go. Mm. Like if they had the full picture, it just doesn't seem like it'd be too huge a leap.
Mm. Now, Colin, you made the editorial choice in this podcast issue instead of telling us what the state's case was, using clips from the Deadly Women show that aired on Investigation Discovery, because basically the Deadly Women show mirrored the prosecution's case. And the show is a pop culture example of this well-known narrative that people tend to believe and buy into around black widows. You know, that if she had one husband who died and another who died, she must have killed him. Colin, do you think that also played into why the jury made the decision they did to convict her?
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, all the people I talked to who were in the courtroom say this was a trial over the death of Johnny Ray. And that a huge part is exactly what the state did. It was to say, look, we might not have evidence that she poisoned him. We might not have a source of that arsenic poisoning. It might be a weak case that she killed Doran. But look, her prior husband was confused in the weeks before his death. He was a good swimmer. He drowned in shallow water. She didn't jump in to save him. She must have killed him for financial gain. And therefore, she's this black widow. She remarried and did the exact same thing to her next husband. I think that that's the narrative that the jury bought.
Wow, someone has
Sorry.
An NASCAR going on behind
them
right there. Oh, that's okay. Were you the train, too? The very atmospheric train whistle that I heard earlier? It's like listening to an episode of Breakdown as we're taping our Undisclosed today. The second half of episode 4 in the Pamela Nair series is all about using the Michael Peterson case, of course, the case that is the center of the documentary The Staircase, as the template for Pam's appeal. Amber, are you familiar with The Staircase and the Michael Peterson case?
Are you seriously asking
Okay,
me that
just checking. How convincing did you find the side-by-side comparison, and which ultimately Colin made the case that his was weaker when it came time to do the appeal?
Yeah, I thought that was a fair analysis. Good job, Colin. You might have a future in this. I always love hearing the different cases that are brought up as, you know, potential precedent or what have you, because of course they're never exactly the same, and I don't, you know, using some painkillers is not on par with having affairs with younger men when you're married. Like they're not totally analogous there. But I did think that the parallels were interesting enough that I could see it playing out in court in her favor.
Rabia, what did you think of this comparison that Colin drew between these two cases?
I think it certainly was used as evidence in Peterson's case. I don't want to go into Peterson's case because I wonder about the owl.
Tell me. Well, you know what? I wrote that question down because, as you know, every time I talk to anybody about this, I have to ask. I have to get them on record. What are your thoughts about the owl theory?
No, I can't be public about it. I'll be lynched. I can't. I've just become that person that I want to err on the side of not putting away the wrong person. And
right.
So I worry. I mean, here's one thing that I wonder about in situations like this. If, with Pam's case, it was different, but in this case, in Peterson's case, it's like, if he had killed a person that way, is he really going to do the exact same thing to another woman? Like,
right.
If you're going to kill another person, you're really going to be that person to do it in the exact same way?
Right.
It would just be really stupid. If you're really going to, like, premeditate and plan it, I don't know, but there's definitely
a thing. Robbie is going with the basic instinct defense there.
I've talked about this before, but that is one of the things that bothers me about it too, because not only was the woman in Germany just some woman, she was the mother of two of the children that Michael Peterson ended up adopting. And wouldn't you think if you were going to kill their stepmother, you would do it in a way that they wouldn't recognize as the same way that their mother died? I would imagine that you might think that through, especially if you're as bright as he is. I don't know. Amber, I have to get you on the record. What do you think about the Michael Peterson case? What do you think of the owl theory?
I think the Peterson case is fascinating. And I'm actually, because I also err on not wanting an innocent person in prison. I am pro owl because I can see it as feasible.
Me too.
I don't want to put the wrong owl in prison either,
but
I just think it's feasible. And we have to think about, you know, just because something's statistically unlikely doesn't mean that it's not possible.
Right. And who says it's statistically unlikely? I mean,
that's true too. That's coming up more and more though, isn't it?
That's right. That's right. Is it more statistically unlikely than being beaten with a fireplace implement that also happens to be in your garage at the same time? I don't know. I don't know. I'm definitely on Team Owl as well. And I don't mean to make light of it. Clearly, it was a death and it's very tragic. But like, there's a lot that's weird about that case, even though, as Colin points out, it is weaker on appeal than all the stuff that exists in Pam's case. Now, Colin, why was the Peterson case resolved under the new evidence standard as opposed to the Brady violation standard?
Yeah, that's interesting. And I'm really thankful they did it under the new evidence standard. They actually raised both on appeals. They said, we have this blood spatter expert, and he essentially lied and concealed his credentials, which were substantially less than what he proffered in court. And so you could slice that two ways. One is to say it's a Brady violation. He's part of the state. And so therefore, this is material exculpatory evidence undermining his credibility that was not turned over to the defense. Or you could have the way the court assessed it, which is to say, oh, this is new evidence that the defense was not aware of and couldn't have obtained at the time of trial. And this new evidence undermines this blood spatter theory and therefore calls into question the sanctity of the conviction. Ultimately, the court says, we think it's best to assess this under the new evidence standard, and as such, we don't need to get to Brady. And again, I'm thankful for that because that makes it a great analog for Pam Lanier. If they did it under Brady, Brady wouldn't be applicable at all to Pam's case. There's nothing that was withheld from the defense. But yeah, they easily could have done it either way, and I'm not sure why they chose new evidence as opposed to Brady.
And new evidence does seem like a strange choice since the new evidence had to do with the expert, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
so the new evidence was that like one of their experts was lying, was like a fraud. That's not evidence. It almost seems like it would be more procedural than evidentiary.
Yeah, we went through the factors for the test under this motion for appropriate relief in North Carolina. And one of them is it has to be new evidence that doesn't simply impeach or call into question the credibility of a state's witness. Well, I would kind of say that that's what this was. I mean, they, in the opinion, say it goes to the actual weight of the evidence of blood spatter as well. But really, it is impeachment evidence. So, yeah, I kind of think the state, in that case, it was really a Brady violation. The court should have done it that way. But again, I'm just very thankful that they did it under the new evidence standard.
Right. And I will make one more plug for any listeners to this podcast who have not checked out The Staircase. It's available on, I think it's available on Sundance now, which I think you can get like a free trial of for 30 days if you needed to. Anyway, it's available there, I think, other places too. And there is an amazing, amazing plot twist when this expert is shown to be a complete and total fraud. It's really like, it's one of the most jaw-dropping things I've ever seen in a true crime documentary. And it's one of the many, many, many reasons why I called The Staircase the Citizen Kane of true crime. So here's a question that came in on Twitter. This is from Leah, and she actually had a really fun question, I think, to think about was, you know, I don't know if Pam has heard any of the podcasts, if she's been able to, but obviously she felt burned by how she was covered on the Deadly Women episode. How does she feel about being in this podcast? And if she's heard any of it or heard about it, how does she feel about the way she's been portrayed?
Yeah, I mean, she was definitely reluctant at first, given what had happened with the Deadly Women series, which she hadn't seen herself, as she notes, but other people hadn't told her about. I haven't had the chance to talk to Pam since the series started airing. And that's because I think I noted before, they're in the process of moving her out of that prison, hopefully to Goldsboro, North Carolina, which is closer to her parents who can't visit her now. But as a result, it's created some difficulty in contacting her. So I was lucky enough to be able to meet her in person. But yeah, since the series has started, I haven't had the chance to talk to her, but I look forward to following up with her. And hopefully she's been able to either hear the series or get transcripts and we can sort of get her take on that.
Amber, can you speak to that about, you know, how the sort of fear and reluctance people have, especially when they've either been named as a suspect or accused or convicted in some cases, about sharing their story because of, you know, previous coverage and because of the way they've been portrayed. Have you had that experience where you've encountered that?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. That's usually one of the biggest obstacles when we're choosing a case is whether we're going to get any cooperation. Not that we necessarily need it from the main person, but it's certainly helpful. And you can't really blame people. Half the time, I'm like, I don't know why people talk to me ever. But I tried to make it clear that I'm not... That Deadly Women show is like the worst in terms of like what scares people away from telling their stories, because it was completely slanted. There's no room for gray, and it's basically taking one side of an argument and only presenting that side. So I try to sell people on this idea that I'm actually interested in the truth. So. Warts and all, you know, tell me what happened here and let me try to find this truth.
Hmm. We have another interesting question, and I'm going to address the first part of it. This is from, I believe her name's Rhea. She says, can we please stop saying that the issue with Michael Peterson was that he was bisexual? So I just want to make it clear, Rhea, we were not saying that, and the undisclosed team was not saying that. That is what the state said. If you watch The Staircase, you will see that they drew a very direct line, not just between his philandering and the crime, but between his bisexuality and the crime, and they absolutely characterized it as a kind of perversion. It is very clear in the documentary, and the documentary actually shows that. So that is not us. That was, I believe, the undisclosed team just saying what happened. But then she also asks her other question, doesn't Pam have a case for ineffective assistance of counsel? Her trial lawyer made some pretty big mistakes. Colin, what do you think?
Yeah, I touched upon this a little bit in the episode, and I think the issue there is it's still this whole maxim that comes from Sherlock Holmes about eliminating the impossible. Should they have called Jackie Graham? Quite possibly. Should they have had Pam testify? Possibly. Should they have done XYZ? But the bottom line is, at the time the case took place, the science was telling them this 3-nitro could not have been the cause of his arsenic poisoning. And I think probably any court looking at ineffective assistance would say, even if there's deficient performance, that's one prong. The other prong is prejudice. And unless you had evidence at the time that would say he could have poisoned himself through the 3-nitro, I don't see this jury reaching a different verdict. And so that's probably why that's not a winning argument.
Now, Robbie, I have a question for you, because I don't think you've been on Addendum since the first week of the Linear series. And of the group, I think after week one, you were... I don't want to say, you know, skeptical, but you were like a little bit skeptical, especially in relation to Pam's potential involvement in the death of her first husband by drowning and you know, the state's right. assertion that like she didn't jump in, which means that, you know, she had to have killed her second husband, which is, you know, mm-hmm. tenuous tie, but they made it. I'm curious, as the series has progressed, have your feelings evolved about the case and about Pam?
Oh, I mean, they certainly have. And look, like I said earlier, I think in that addendum, actually, I watched that stupid clip, that documentary, what is it called?
Deadly Most Women.
Deadly Women, excuse me. you know, the title itself, I mean, it's just such shallow coverage. It's not investigative reporting. I really don't like that kind of style of storytelling, I guess, like when, especially when it comes to these kinds of cases. It's just completely salacious, but it's effective. So I watched it and then it kind of stuck with me. And yeah, of course. I mean, like, and I, on my own also, I spoke to Pam's aunt numerous times. I spoke to her nephew. Unfortunately, I wasn't able to get him on the record. I have to say, I have the most trouble, I think, of our whole team trying to get people to like talk to me on the record. I think people are just confused by like, and also, I mean, it depends on where we are, but like my name and like, what does she do? I don't know. I have a lot of trouble. So it's better for me to be like, maybe I should make up a name. I should be like, I'm not Rabia Chaudhry. I'm like somebody else, but I don't know if that's
Susan
ethical.
Simpson.
I'm Susan Simpson.
Rabia, some of the reporting on like the cert petition and stuff refers to you as Rabia O. Chaudhry.
Oh, I love it.
That is interesting. Yeah.
That's... they can't do basic research. That's amazing. But anyway, no, I didn't see that. Okay.
That's like your Twitter avatar handle right now, yeah. Right?
Jarabi Ocho. There is my Twitter handle. It's just a joke. But anyway, but anyhow, I'd spoken to them at length and, you know, they were lovely and they, everything they told me was like, none of this is, it was all ridiculous. Everything the state said was ridiculous. I mean, you know, it was so clear what was happening and she, Pam, tried so hard and she, you know, they had a great marriage. It's like ruined her life in so many ways. And there's so many people who witnessed him doing this to himself. So yeah, as I got deeper into the case, obviously I also, you know, talked to other people. I saw their evidence and, but it's hard even as somebody who does this work all the time not to fall into those traps. And I did. I fell into the deadly woman trap.
Yeah. Well, there's, you know, it's not uncommon. There's an interesting documentary available on HBO about the Pam Smart case, a local case here in New Hampshire, about a teacher who had an affair with a student and then went to prison for orchestrating her husband's murder at the hands of the student and this other boy with whom she traded sexual favors allegedly for this killing. Anyway, it's a very complicated case. It has a lot to do with, in the documentary, looks at the media around the case. It was one of the first televised trials in the United States and how that affected potentially the outcome of the case. And one of the most interesting things they found, you know, in talking to people for this documentary is that when people think of the Pam Smart case, they conflate it with the fictional film To Die For starring Nicole Kidman that was written based on, it was a novel written based on a fictionalized version of the case. And when people are asked today about the details of the Pam Smart case, they'll recite back details from the novel or the film starring Nicole Kidman, which, you know, I think is interesting. Like, you know, would a potential juror today, if she got an appeal, perhaps be influenced by that piece of media? You know, it's effective. That's why, you know, I don't know. I mean, there is something there that's influential and scarily so, I think. And Amber, you know, as a fellow true crime writer, you've probably, well, I'm not going to say that you have. Have you participated in any of these as I have? Because that for a long time was the only media around true crime.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I don't think I did Deadly Women, but I've done some with some just cheesy, terrible titles. usually, though, I feel pretty comfortable in the case if I agree to do a certain type of true crime show. But the stuff that I try to do, especially if there's nuance to the case, I try to make sure that I'm participating, you know, with something that's a little more journalistically sound.
Right.
Because the ethics do matter. I mean, I take it very seriously when I'm reporting on something.
That's right. And, you know, sometimes even if they put in exactly what you said and then they use a clip running behind your voice of a woman wearing lingerie when in real life that woman was not wearing lingerie, that's awful. And that happens all the time on these shows. And I know especially it happens on Deadly Women because not only have I seen that show, but my husband has been on that show, which is something I'm not as proud of as I used to be before listening to this series.
It is pretty interesting when you hear just the how much the music affects you and the tone of voice.
Right.
It's eye-opening as somebody who's doing more and more audio reporting.
Yeah, I mean, that's one of the things I love about your show. It's one of the things I love about the show In the Dark. In fact, the women who make In the Dark did a talk at a podcast conference that both Rabia and I attended where they talked about exactly that thing. And they played a clip from their show and they played the same clip and showed what it would sound like if they put that cheesy, ominous music underneath it. And it didn't sound as good. It didn't sound like it had as much integrity. Let's put it that way. Now, Colin, another question from someone on Twitter. This is from Meredith, who says, is there any reason to think that if he had mental impairment from ingesting the 3-nitro, he, I assume she's talking about Dorian, could have been improperly mixing higher levels over time? It would be interesting to know if remaining mix on the day of his death had higher arsenic levels than normal. Can you address that, Colin?
Yeah. And so first, we know that this mixture of water and 3-nitro that was found after his death, which presumably he mixed that morning, had a higher concentration of arsenic than the water should have had if there were proper dilution of the 3-nitro in the water. So whether he was doing that in escalation, whether that was always the dose he had, we're not sure. That said, we could certainly explain neurological issues based upon his prolonged ingestion of the 3-nitro. We didn't air this clip on the episode, but here is a clip from the experts talking about the neurological effects of arsenic.
Also in the same paper that describes acute arsenic poisoning, it mentions acute psychosis,
Yeah, they do talk about, I found this in several papers, that with these kinds of doses, there's discussions of, you know, a variety of neurologic symptoms and neuropsychosis. So, you know, some of this behavior, including the drinking of arsenic, could have been kind of a circular feeling. He started drinking arsenic and then kind of lost his sense of judgment and kept on drinking arsenic.
So, Colin, one of the final voices we hear in the podcast is Pam's. What can you tell us about the status of her appeal? Do you think there's likelihood of success here or not?
Yeah, so A, I think there's a great likelihood of success. I think that the Michael Peterson case is a terrific precedent that really the Wake Forest attorneys can hang their hat on and say, our case is not only similar but stronger than that case in terms of a new trial. They're hoping to file for that new trial this summer, maybe July or so. Just dotting some I's and crossing some T's. Actually, while we're recording, I got an email. This is at 4:01 p.m. on Wednesday, May 16th, from the Center for Veterinary Medicine. As you heard on the episode, there was this reported incident they have in the adverse drug effect report about this person dying from ingestion of 3-nitro. I tried a few different avenues with them to get more information on that, and I just got an email back today finally saying you have to do a FOIA request. So that's our next step. That's essentially one of the last things we need to do before we file is get this information through a FOIA request, where hopefully there's additional information about this death that says something very similar, that this person who died was a turkey farmer or a poultry farmer who somehow ingested the 3-nitro and that was the precipitating event that caused his death. So yeah, a few things to cross off the list, but I think we have a very good shot at winning this appeal.
Now, Amber, your second season of Accused was about the wrongful conviction of William Virgil for killing Aretha Welch. And the latest reporting on his case seems to be a January article from you about him seeking grand jury testimony. What can you tell us about the status of his case?
It's funny how slowly this all works, but in the podcast, we mentioned that there's a civil suit underway, and that's still underway. So that's Virgil suing the city and the police department and such for violating rights. So the one development that is kind of interesting is that they want my notes and my recordings. So they've subpoenaed for those, or they've officially requested them, and we're saying
no. Wait, who
has?
The state has?
Not Virgil's lawyers. Mm-hmm. Yeah, the in this case, the defense. So, but what I found was interesting, because I'm actually, it's unusual for a reporter to not be overprotective of her notes. In this case, I'm not, because I actually want to find out who killed Aretha Welch. And if my work can help you do that, hey, that sounds great. But the things requested from them are very clearly meant to get out of paying Virgil, not figure out who killed this woman.
Right.
So yeah, I mean, I don't work for the police, or so we're not handing them over willingly. So we'll see what happens with that. But we're still waiting to hear about depositions, and there should be more coming out, and I'm hoping to be able to update that case.
Now, Amber, a few months ago, we had occasion to get together and have a drink and some food together, and it was because you were working on it at the time, what was a super secret podcast project, and now we know that that podcast project is Aftermath Podcast, which comes out on Tuesday, May 22nd. I'll give it a plug again. What can you tell us about that podcast?
I've had the idea for this one for literally about 8 years. So when I stopped writing for the Detroit Free Press, I covered crime there for a long time. I left and I actually had this fellowship, and I mapped out this idea to try to report on survivors of gun violence, because I had to go to so many scenes where people were shot. And basically, if they didn't die, you kind of walk away, because you know, you can't report on every shooting, especially not in a city like Detroit. But I had interviewed enough of the survivors to know that, you know, just because they survived, their story wasn't over. Some of them might be paralyzed. Some might have PTSD. Some might have a colostomy bag for the rest of their lives. So Aftermath is interviewing survivors with the aim of trying to shed light on that experience and show what the similarities and the differences are. And so I went all across the country. I met you, IRL, in New Hampshire. And that was for episode 1. I met a woman out there. And I went to Seattle and Detroit and Oakland and just all over. And I'm pretty proud of it, largely because it is the culmination of a lot of years of thinking, you know, we just don't cover this enough. And I get why we can't do it resources wise, but these stories really do matter.
Mm. Now, Amber, there's a trailer already available for Aftermath, correct?
That is correct.
So I will tell people listening to this show, go to your podcast app, look for Aftermath, download the trailer and subscribe so that you will not miss the first episode of Amber's new podcast. She is one of the fiercest and best reporters I've ever met, and I know I'll be listening. So I'm just going to make it a plug for you, Amber. I really think that listeners to Undisclosed, it sounds exactly like something that is in their wheelhouse. So congratulations on bringing it out and letting us all take a listen, and good luck with the rest of the project. And most importantly, thank you so much for joining me to talk about the Pam Lanier case, the Michael Peterson case, the owl theory, and everything that's been happening on Undisclosed in the last few weeks. Thank you so much, Amber.
Oh, so happy to.
And Rabia, I know that you are a very busy person, and it's a very busy time of year, and there's a lot going on. And it is just always such a pleasure to talk to you and hear your take on these cases. So thanks so much, Rabia.
Thanks for the great conversation, Rebecca.
And Colin, I've said it all the last of the weeks that I've been hosting this show, you know, doing this, hosting Addendum, sitting in these big John Cryer shaped shoes would not have been possible without your diligent research and incredible notes. And you're also just so much fun to talk to, and you know everything. And it's just always such a pleasure. Thank you, Colin.
Well, Rebecca, thank you so much for hosting these addenda. You've added an interesting element to the addenda, and yeah, it's tough to fill John's shoes, but you've done a terrific job.
Oh, thanks. Thanks so much for listening to this week's addendum and to the series on the Pam Lanier case. It's been a pleasure to produce it and an honor to try to fill those big, talented shoes of host John Cryer for the past few weeks. This is an understudy gig I never thought someone like me could get. If you want to hear more of my take on true crime and true crime media, check out my show Crime Writers On. And if you love the addendum and Undisclosed, please rate this show on Apple Podcasts. The executive producer of the Undisclosed team is Meethal Telhan, without whom this show and the work it does would not be possible. Audio production for the addendum is done by the brilliant and talented Hannah McCarthy, one of the two new hosts of the excellent must-listen podcast Civics 101. Music for the show is by Patrick Cortez. On behalf of the whole Undisclosed team, thanks again for the listen, and we look forward to bringing you more stories of justice and injustice in the months to come.